Okay, now that we're back from break, we're going to continue looking at the question that we were looking at last time. In particular, we're going to talk about choosing a passage. These are all related to getting first things first. We were just talking about the importance of submitting the mind and heart to God as a preliminary step in studying the Old Testament historical books. Also, in order to study, you need to choose a passage. You need to choose a focus of study, and you want to define that passage rightly. Sometimes if you truncate or cut off a passage inappropriately, you may miss its message, you may miss its point. Now, the episodic character of the biblical narratives makes it fairly easy to choose a passage, because we do have in the Old Testament what might be described as a scenic mode of narration. By that, I do not mean that it just goes into elaborate description, you know, the hills and were looking lovely that evening and so forth and so on. It doesn't talk a lot about scenery per se, but it's scenic in the same way that a dramatic stage play operates in scenes and in acts. You know, act one, scene two, or whatever, if I'm not flipping those around inappropriately. But the biblical narrative is scenic in this sense. It is episodic in nature. These episodes in the Bible generally involve a limited number of actors or characters on stage, two, possibly three, one of whom is often God. There may be a crowd in the background, but you seldom have more than three active participants in a given scene. The scene also is defined by change in time or change in place. And so if you look, for instance, at 1 Samuel chapter 13, this is a good example of how we can recognize a unit of text quite easily. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, after the regnal formula of verse 1, which says Saul was, the NIV says, 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel 42 years. The 30 and the 40 are not actually in the text, raises a big question of its own, which we'll not get into at the moment. But in verse 2, it says, Saul chose 3,000 men from Israel. 2,000 were with him at Michmash in the hill country of Bethel. 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah in Benjamin. The rest of the men were sent back to their homes. So we learn right there that the main characters are going to be Saul and Jonathan. We learn of their location. And it's not until verse 3 that we get into the action as Jonathan attacks the Philistine garrison, Philistine outpost, Geba. Well, the action continues really until we come to verse 15, which also is a little bit of a difficulty textually. But at any rate, without getting into that, in verse 15, the actors who have been on stage, first Saul and Jonathan, then Samuel comes on stage, the actors part. Samuel goes his way, and Saul goes his way, and we later learn that Saul has returned to join Jonathan. So very much as in the same way that an episode or a scene of a dramatic play involves one place, a given set of actors, someone may be added in, and comes on stage, but when the actors change and the place changes, generally you have a different episode, a different scene. Now, this makes it pretty easy to divide up the narrative text into workable units, objects of study. I do want to stress, however, the special importance of the broader context. You can hardly understand one scene of a play if you haven't been watching the rest of the play. And even if you think you understand it, you may be misunderstanding it and misconstruing the significance of that scene. So it's very important to read the entire story. Work on that episode, but work on it in the light of the broader context. For instance, in this same chapter we were just looking at, in verse 8 of 1 Samuel 13, it says, Saul waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal. And that raises a question. What time set by Samuel? This is an allusion to some earlier event. Apparently there was an agreement that Samuel and Saul should meet in Gilgal. When did that happen? That's a question we have to ask. And that will send us to the broader context. My view is that that will send us back to chapter 10, verse 8, the time of Saul's first commission. Later in this course, we'll talk about how we can understand the rise of Saul and the nature of Saul's offense, why it was that Samuel reacts as harshly as he does in this particular chapter to what appears to some people to be a mere inadvertence on Saul's part. I would also argue, most people recognize that allusion there, but some miss the fact that when Jonathan attacks the Philistine garrison at Geba, I would argue that that refers us back to the verse in chapter 10 that immediately precedes the order to go to Gilgal. In chapter 10, verse 7, Samuel tells Saul that he should do what his hand finds to do. Now, Saul finds himself at Gibeah Elohim, where there is a garrison of the Philistines, and my argument later will be that Saul should have attacked the outpost, attacked the garrison. That's what Jonathan does just here. And so as we read a particular scene, a particular episode, we need to be careful to read it in the light of the ongoing story, because often you will not understand what's going on in a given text unless you look more broadly. Ian Proven, a friend of mine who's written a King's commentary that's supposed to come out by November, and I think will be the best King's commentary on the market at that point, he argues that very often discussions of Solomon's wisdom begin in the wrong place. Most people start talking about Solomon's wisdom in 1 Kings chapter 3 when God comes to Solomon and says, "What can I do for you?" And he says, "I feel like a child. You know, give me a discerning heart." And God is pleased and says, "Okay, since you've asked an unselfish request, I'll give you, not only will I give you wisdom, but riches and honor to boot." Well, Dr. Proven suggests that really Solomon's wisdom is first mentioned in chapter 2, where David says to Solomon, "Look, you're a man of wisdom. You know there's some difficult people in the kingdom. You'll know what to do with Shimei and Joab and these other guys." In other words, he's saying, "You've got the smarts. Rid yourselves of yourself of these problems." And Solomon does just that. And it's after the exercise of his wisdom that in chapter 3 he confesses to God, "I feel like a child. I don't know what I'm doing. I've just put into effect a bit of a bloodbath here, and I'm not sure it's gotten me anywhere. I don't know what I'm doing. I need your wisdom." And so by reading, beginning in the right place in analysis of Solomon's wisdom, it lets us know that, yeah, Solomon had a wisdom of his own, a human wisdom, and then there was also the God-given wisdom that came and was given to Solomon when he reached the end of his wisdom, when he realized that his was not doing well. So we need, when we're reading these episodes, when we choose a passage, be sure to read it in light of the overall sweep and structure of the book. You know, in terms of the major sections, recognize that some boundaries in biblical books are artificial. I'm sure you know that chapter divisions are not inspired, and so you don't want to allow chapter divisions to overly influence your interpretation. Now, the challenge of getting a grasp on the larger story is perhaps one of the reasons that many preachers seldom preach from the biblical narratives. And many teachers seldom teach from the biblical narratives. Or if they do, they may teach kind of moralizing, moralistic sermons, be like David or be like Daniel, without really understanding the overarching dynamic of what God is doing in this particular story. It is a challenge to read the larger context and get to know it, but that's what we're about, you know, taking on challenges and over a lifetime getting better and better at that. Now, as you read one episode in the light of its broader context, you want to look for linkages between that episode and the surrounding chapters, the surrounding texts. I was just mentioning the linkage between 1 Samuel 13:8 and 10:8, which I think is the order which is being then fulfilled four chapters later. Likewise, if you're reading the story of Jacob, remember the story of Jacob's deception in Genesis 27, when he deceived his father, made him think that he was Esau, and having earlier, more or less, purchased the birthright in chapter 27 of Genesis, he steals the blessing. Now, what's curious is that most of us as readers are asking ourselves, and this is a patriarch? You know, does God approve this? He got away with this. I can't believe it. You know, he left, he dressed himself up, his mom was in cahoots with him. He stole the blessing and got away with it. I cannot believe that. Is that approved? Ah, well, that's Old Testament. No, that, you can't do that. Can't just say, ah, it's Old Testament. What happens is, two chapters later, we discover that the deceiver, the man who deceived his father, stole from his brother, himself is deceived by his relative. Remember, he worked 7 years for Laban's daughter, Rachel. And what happened? He got Leah and had to work another 7 for Rachel. The deceiver deceived. So though we're sort of on pins and needles for a while, wondering, is there justice? Is all right with the universe? Is God still in control? 2 chapters later, we discover that, yeah, we do reap what we sow. And we're able to rest. But sometimes we have to wait, and sometimes we have to continue reading before a question that's raised in our mind, a gap in our understanding, is filled. That is one of the standard techniques in Old Testament narrative is to use a device called gapping. That is to raise a question in our minds that piques our interest, maybe perplexes us, but it engages us with the text. And as we read, the text often will provide the information to fill the gap, to answer the question. But we must read the broader context. So much for choosing a passage. Any questions on that or comments on choosing a passage? Yes? It depends on the purposes of your study. I think most of the scenes in the biblical narratives are fairly reasonable. You know, they could be teaching texts if you're teaching Sunday school, or preaching texts if you're a preacher. Most of them are manageable, you know, somewhere 10 to 15 verses, but it obviously varies quite widely. So it depends on your purpose. If your purpose is communication, you know, you're preparing a message for some context, then you may need to limit yourself to, you know, 10, 15 verses, not much more than that. If the narrative cannot be understood without bringing more in, then you need to bring it in, but you may not be able to read it all at the beginning. But in the telling of the story, you can explain it. I have preached from 1 Kings 9, in which it's mentioned that the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time. Well, you know, obviously, I've got to go back to 1 Kings 3 the first time, and that's got to be a part of that message, because the narrator goes out of his way to say, God appeared to him a second time. And we'll see that when we get into the life of Solomon. Other questions? By the way, the question was, how big a text should we choose? I forgot to repeat the question. Other questions? Okay. Yes, sir. Right. Yeah, if you're choosing, like, the genealogies in Chronicles, can those make teaching or preaching texts? Can we learn things from them? Oh, yes, we can. It's a bit of a challenge, and what we want to do is try to find out why that genealogy is significant in the Bible. We don't want to just come up with some clever use of the genealogy to say something we want to say. And so it does require some diligent study and to say, okay, what's going on in this genealogy? It's interesting, in one class I taught, there was a woman there who had been a missionary in Cameroon, and she said, whereas we, many of us Westerners, don't have much need of or room for or appreciation of genealogies, we read that and we say, man, that is dry as dust. You know, why is that in there? Her experience in working with translators who had translated the Old Testament into a language in her area, they had told her that it was when their readers came to the genealogies that suddenly their eyes brightened and they said, oh, this is history. This really happened. See, so to them, in their culture, a genealogy was a very forceful and important literary form, whereas for us, we kind of, you know, we don't know what to make of it. But it's there for a purpose. And the challenge is to discover what was God's reason for including that genealogy. Okay. All right. Well, let's move on and ask now, how do you go about establishing the text? And I'm going to say something that may shock you. How do you establish the text? Well, by that I mean, how do you determine, as best we can, what the original text said? And what I'm going to say to shock you is that we should acknowledge the primacy of the Hebrew text. Now, the reason I say that is that I know that most of you in this class have not had Hebrew and may not ever have a chance to take Hebrew, but if you have a chance, definitely take it. I'll be glad to teach it. I'd love to have you in class. But I think we need to acknowledge the primacy of the Hebrew text to prevent ourselves from asking the kind of question that I get asked sometimes, what's the best English translation? As if somehow we will ever get to a translation that does it all. We have a saying that says you always lose something in translation. Even at its best, translation involves, as Bruce Metzger says, quoting another translator, the art of a good translation is the art of making the right sacrifice. You're always going to lose something in translation, so the key is sacrificing the right thing that will enable you to stay within your particular brief, what it is your translation is seeking to accomplish. The Italians are a little more ruthless. The Italians say, traduttore, traditori, the translator is a traitor. Now that's a bit much, I think. You know, it's a little over the top, but if it makes a point, it's worth making. Now I'm not for a minute saying that the English translation that we read is inadequate, that it can't communicate God's Word to us or anything else. But by acknowledging the primacy of the Hebrew text, we recognize that there's an original text back there that the English Bible is a translation of. And in fact, the fact that we cannot come up with a perfect translation is well attested by the statistic that since 1952... shortly after I was born, long before any of you were born, shortly after, from 1952 to 1989, there were 26 English translations of the full Bible created and published, and another 25 English translations of the New Testament. Now, that tells me two things. One, publishers want to make a lot of money on Bible translations. That's possibly one of the major motives. But also, there's a sense on the part of those doing those translations that we can improve on that last one. There's always something you lose in translation. So, you know, the original language is important. But what do you do if you're a realist and you say, all right, I haven't had Hebrew, I'm not going to have Hebrew, and I recognize that's the state of most people in the world today, most people in the church. What do you do? What's the best thing to do? Well, don't latch on to a single English translation and treat it as if it's the original text and there is no original text, the primacy of the Hebrew text. There's no original text back there. What you want to do for serious study is to surround yourself with a couple of English translations. Surround with a couple. Maybe surround with three English translations and know what those English translations are trying to accomplish. For instance, what is the New American Standard Version known for? Being literal, a literal translation, yeah, word for word, which is of course impossible, but they strive to be as word for word as possible. It tries to be lexically accurate. That is, it tries to be as accurate as it possibly can in dealing with the words of the text. Now, I'm sure you recognize that if you take any given word in the Hebrew that has this range of meaning, you know, these are the various nuances or connotations of that word, an English word may incorporate some of those nuances but have some nuances of its own. Seldom do you have a word in English and a word in, say, Hebrew or Greek for the New Testament that precisely overlap in their range of meaning. So what the translator tries to do is to choose the most appropriate English word to capture the connotation of that Hebrew or Greek word as it functions in a particular sentence. That's the reason that the same word in Hebrew or Greek is often translated by a different word in different contexts. So we need to recognize that English translations are that. They're all coming from a particular vantage point, and they all must sacrifice something. What is the New International Version known for? More thought for thought. Okay, good. Thought for thought as opposed to word for word. Yeah? Okay, it strives to be more readable, let's say. Okay, and getting away from the word for word enables it to have the freedom to try to be more readable in English. Which is more accurate, the New American Standard or the NIV? I heard two answers, the New American Standard or the NIV. You kind of have to say accurate in what sense? Look at Amos chapter 8, verse 2. It's one of my favorite examples. Ezekiel, Daniel, Joel, Amos, chapter 8. We could begin in verse 1. Okay, who has either the New King James or the NASB? I know there's an NASB. There's got to be an NASB here. Yes, would you read for... Actually, since this is being taped, let me read it. Otherwise, I'd have to repeat your reading. Amos chapter 8, verses 1 and 2. Thus the Lord showed me, and behold, there was a basket of summer fruit. And he said, "What do you see, Amos?" And I said, "A basket of summer fruit." Then the Lord said to me, "The end has come for my people Israel. I will spare them no longer." Okay. What do you make of that? I mean, that's a little tough. You know, you're doing your inductive Bible study and you come to Amos 1 and 2, and though it's inductive, you're the shall answer man or woman. You're supposed to know all the answers, having been to a night class or two at the seminary and such. What do you see, Amos? I said, a basket of summer fruit. The Lord said to me, "The end has come for my people Israel. I will spare them no longer." And you begin to do your mental gymnastics and scrambling and said, well, summer fruit is probably, you know, overripe and about rotten. And so he's saying maybe things are about rotten and the end is near for my people Israel and so forth and so on. Close, but not exactly right. Now, what does the NIV say? Again, I would have you read it, but for the fact that we're being taped, I'll read it to you. Notice how the NIV renders this verse. This is what the Sovereign Lord showed me, a basket of ripe fruit. "What do you see, Amos?" he asked. "A basket of ripe fruit," I answered. Then the Lord said to me, "The time is ripe for my people Israel. I will spare them no longer." Now that makes a little more sense, doesn't it? "What do you see? A basket of ripe fruit." That's right, the time is ripe for my people Israel. Now how do we get those two different translations? Good Study Bible probably has a study note in there. Probably your NASB has a study note in there, that would say to you that the word for end and the word for summer sound alike in Hebrew, in the original Hebrew text. The word for summer is kaitz, and the word for end is kates. And so God gives a vision that contains a word play. What do you see? Kluv kaitz, a basket of summer. And then he says, that's right. You saw kaitz, and kates is coming for my people Israel. The end has come. Now, I repose the question. Which is more accurate, the NASB or the NIV? Someone said the NIV. Anyone want to go for NASB? It depends on your perspective, all right? Elaborate. Depends on your perspective. Okay, very good. Very good. If you want the literal words, the NASB will come closer to giving you the connotation of those words, summer and end. If you want... Let me rephrase it slightly. If you want to capture the rhetorical force of the text, which involves a wordplay, the NIV, as a dynamic equivalence translation, strives to capture that wordplay. And that's, as you point out, why you need both. For serious study, you may need at times to have several Bibles around you. And that will help alert you to the full range of what's going on in the original text. Now again, if you have opportunity to learn Hebrew, then you can read the text and see both at once. But barring that, you can certainly get very far along in this kind of study by surrounding yourself with good translations and knowing where they're coming from, what they're trying to accomplish. So, establish the text, acknowledge the primacy of the Hebrew text, and then use your translations intelligently. Know what they're trying to accomplish. Sometimes, as you get into reading Howard, I want to make a subsidiary point here, another point. Sometimes... as Howard points out on page 24, if you've gotten that far, it's important to notice not only the big things about a text, but the microscopic details. He says, the hope is that the readers, with little experience in close and careful reading of the Bible, will learn to pay equal attention to microscopic details and macroscopic structures. It is in the details, as well as in the large-scale sweeps, that we learn about the messages of the biblical books and ultimately about God. Now, the reason I say that is that sometimes those little details are apparent more in the original text, in Hebrew, than they are in English. And in order to get an understanding of those, sometimes you have to just go to a commentary. You know, your study can be enriched by a good commentary. One example would be in the election of Saul and then the subsequent election of David. In chapter 8 of 1 Samuel, verse 22, God condescends to do what the elders are demanding. They say, give us a king like all the nations. And he says, okay, Samuel, first warn them. This is ill-timed. It's inappropriate what they're asking. But having warned them, if they insist, go ahead and give for them a king. And the for them stands out a bit more in the Hebrew than it does in English. Then after Saul has had his day, and indeed his day in court, and has been rejected by God at the end of chapter 15, moving on into chapter 16, God says to Samuel, how long are you going to continue to grieve for Saul? I have found for me a king. Little detail, subtle detail, a point for them a king, I found for me a king. But it's a very significant thing. David was God's choice. Saul was the people's choice. The people learned a lesson. Saul learned a lesson. But then God in His grace gave them His choice nevertheless. So sometimes quite a freight of meaning is contained in small details. If you need any help in trying to determine what a translation is intending to do, read the foreword. Read the preface to the translation. There are also some good third-party assessments of translations. Let me just mention one. There's a book by Jack Lewis entitled The English Bible from KJV to NIV, A History and Evaluation. And the second edition of that book actually presses beyond the NIV, because the NIV has been out for some time. It goes on and talks about some more recent translations, such as the Revised English Bible and the New RSV, the New Revised Standard Version. So I commend that to you. That's Baker Bookhouse, 1991. And there you can get an assessment of the relative value of these different translations. But if you're a serious student, you may carry the NIV or the NASB most of the time, but at least have the complement on your desk when you go to doing serious study. Okay, well, having established the text, I'm not going to talk a lot about textual criticism and that sort of thing, although that is part of the process. It's just that is a little more difficult to do on the basis of the English text. You may become alerted to some textual variants, even from the footnotes to a study Bible, that may say the So Septuagint, So reading with the Septuagint, the Greek translation. The Masoretic text, that is the Hebrew, has this other thing. And so you'll be alerted to the fact that those who've done the translation have had to wrestle with what is the right reading, what is the original text here. And so at this stage, you'll pretty much have to just be aware of what's there. It's a little difficult to get into the nuts and bolts of doing that yourself. You may read about it in commentaries and such, and can make decisions. The simplest rubric, and I'll just give you one principle, the kind of all-encompassing principle of text criticism is that reading is most likely to be original, which most easily explains how the other readings arose. Okay? That reading is most likely to be original, which most easily explains how the others arose. That's a pretty kind of logical thing. But at times you may bring that to bear in your study. But most of the time you'll be reading the text and noticing, okay, there's a difference here. You may go to a commentary to see which is really to be preferred. Or you simply trust the NIV translators or the NASB translators to have made a wise decision for you. Now, having established the text, chosen the text, and then established, you've looked at several translations, you know if there are any difficulties in the translation and you're aware of that. Then you want to begin to read the text. And I've divided this really into three major sections. You want to read the text literarily. You want to reflect on the text historically. And then you want to respond to the text theologically. So we'll take those up in order. And the reading the text literarily, as you can see from the number of subpoints, it will take us a little longer than the others. Well, first of all, as you get into reading a text, reading a narrative, you want to look for general literary features, a kind of general poetics. Poetics is a term that is used to describe that attempt to write a grammar of literature. You know how a language operates on certain principles. Native speakers are unaware of these certain principles, but those who come in and learn that language as a second language often recognize, okay, these are the principles at work, and they write a grammar, construct a grammar in their mind, and that helps them to grasp that language more quickly. So languages have grammatical structure. Likewise, certain types of literature, such as biblical narrative, have a grammatical structure, a literary grammatical structure. In terms of general principles of narrative, you'll expect to find things like plot. Narratives typically have plot. If they don't have some kind of plot and theme, then they're hardly a narrative. They may be a stream of consciousness, prose composition, but you would hardly call it a narrative. You expect to find plot. You expect to find this plot to involve a point of tension, or more than one point of tension that arises in the narrative and then presses toward resolution. So the tension arises and then you seek to see how that is resolved. You expect there to be some climax in this narrative or even in the episode. Often in biblical narratives, and this is a little distinctive perhaps of biblical narrative, the climax is reached in a situation of dialogue, where actors on stage are speaking, where the characters are speaking with one another. That's where you'll find the climactic portion of most narratives. Another general feature of narratives is characterization. You expect that those individuals that figure in the narrative are somehow characterized by the writer. Often this characterization is not done directly. Often the narrator doesn't simply say, Eli's sons were wicked men. Now, sometimes he does. But often he shows us that Eli's sons were wicked men, or that this other character was this way or that way. Need I mention Absalom, who was obviously prideful about hair? Let that be a warning unto you. He cut his hair and weighed it and made a big deal about it so that it was recorded in the annals of history. And his full head of hair did him in. Let that be a warning to you. But that was an indirect mode of characterization. Sometimes physical features are mentioned. Eli's dim-sightedness. Now, why did the narrator choose to talk about Eli being dim-sighted and overweight? Well, because both of those sort of stand for something else that's going on in Eli's life. He was dim-sighted physically, but he had grown dim-sighted spiritually. He was no longer seeing clearly. Moreover, he had grown corpulent. He had added weight to himself physically, and God charged him with giving more weight to himself and his sons than he was giving to God. And God said, those who honor me, those who give me weight, I will give weight to. Those who esteem me lightly will be lightly esteemed. So the narrator often will characterize through indirect means. And thus we give close attention to the details in the text, because sometimes those carry a lot of meaning for us. Another standard feature of narratives is what we call point of view. What is the point of view of the narrator? What is it that the narrator, how does the narrator view what he is talking about, and how does he want us to view it? Also, what are the points of view that are found in the depiction itself? In other words, if you're reading, let's say, in the book of Job, and one of Job's friends says something, it's important to recognize that that statement is coming from the point of view of Job's so-called comforter, one of his friends. You don't just view it all as being from the narrator's point of view or from the poet's point of view. You ask the question, who is saying what about whom in what context? What is the point of view of this particular statement? So point of view, again, is something that's talked about a lot in literary studies. Plot, characterization, point of view. These are the kinds of things that you would hear if you took a course on literature in the English corpus. They're generally, this is part of general poetics, what you would find in many different kinds of narrative. Beyond that, we want to be alerted to and thus looking for specific literary features that are very typical of the Bible and a biblical narrative. This I would call special poetics or biblical poetics. I've mentioned one of these already, and that is that the biblical narratives tend to be scenic. They tend to be constructed like the scenes of a play. I've hinted at one of the other, and that is that the biblical narratives tend to be succinct. They tend to be very economic in the way the story is told. There's not a lot of wasting of words in biblical narratives. And because they're so economic, it calls upon us to look carefully and closely at every detail in the text. They also can be quite subtle, to continue this string of S's, scenic, succinct, and subtle. Because they make their points sometimes indirectly, their point can be made quite subtly, and it's worth noticing that. It's worth looking for subtleties in the text. Now, sometimes you may feel that you're in danger of reading things into the text, and indeed that's a possibility. If you claim that there's a subtlety there and no one else seems to see it and you can't convince anyone else that it's there, then it's probably in your mind and not in the text. But just because that's a danger does not mean there are not subtleties in the text that we should seek. So the texts are subtle, and we should be alert to that. Reading a good commentary, such as the King's commentary that I mentioned before by Ian Provin, and by the way, he's not giving me a cut of his royalties or anything. That's not why I keep mentioning it. But reading that can alert you to subtleties in the text that you might otherwise overlook. Let me give you one example that I know he will address in his commentary. In 2 Kings chapter 5, turn there with me. 2 Kings chapter 5, beginning in verse 10. This is the story. Oops, I'm in 1 Kings. This is the story of Naaman. 2 Kings chapter 5, beginning in verse 10. You know that Naaman was the man with leprosy whose young servant girl was Israelite, and she said, if you go to Israel, your leprosy can be cured. And so he made a trip with that in mind. And in verse 10, having been approached by Naaman, Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, go, wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed. But Naaman went away angry and said, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot, and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than any of the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? So he turned and went off in rage. But Naaman's servants, who I think had been listening more closely, went to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed? Now, the reason I rushed over that is I think that here's an example where Provin's commentary will help you with a translation. I think he's got a better translation of the Hebrew text than what is normally here. Because the way the text actually reads is just like the words of the serpent in Genesis chapter 3 when the serpent says to Eve, did God really say, you shall not eat of any of the trees of the garden? It's the same phrase. And so, noting that, Provin has suggested that really there's not a question being asked here. And indeed, there's no marker of a question in the original text. But rather, Naaman's servant come to him and they say, my father, a great thing the prophet has said to you. Will you not do it? Okay? Not how much more than when he tells you what. Then it goes on to say, did he really say, just as in Genesis 3, did he really say, wash and be cleansed? Now, this you have to wrap your mind around this a little bit, but one of the special features of biblical narrative we'll discover is repetition and the importance of repetition and repetition with variation. So listen again to what Elisha said. Go, wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored to you, and you will be cleansed. Listen to what Naaman heard. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than any of the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? And the servants say, did he really say to you, wash and be cleansed? Now, they're not coming right out and saying, listen up, stupid. But they're saying, think about it. Is that really what he said? Because you see, Naaman apparently assumes that he's come all this way And he was expecting that Elisha would come out and wave his hand and, you know, do some big drama, or wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. But he has heard simply that Elisha has commanded him to go and do some kind of ceremonial cleansing. He's not real happy about that because the Jordan may be muddy at the time, and he's got good rivers for ceremonial cleansing back home. And the servants say, wait a minute, did he really say that? Just wash and be cleansed? Think it through again. What did Elisha say? Go, wash yourself seven times in Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed. Okay? That begins to make a whole lot more sense of this episode. Naaman, because of the way, the mechanism, and it sounded a little bit like a ritual cleansing, he overlooked the very significant statement, your flesh will be restored. He had been promised that for which he had come, and he almost left without it, but his servants were listening. Oftentimes the servants in the Bible are doing a little bit better than their masters at listening to what's going on. So, our task as we approach the Bible is to be good listeners. You know, the principle of real estate is, you know, what are the three important things about real estate? Location, location, and location. What are the three important things in biblical interpretation? Listen, listen, listen. Really pay attention. And sometimes you will discover things that surprise you if you simply observe very closely. Other times you will discover things, as I was just explaining to you, that you might not be able to discover just from the English translations, but until one of them comes along and adopts Ian Provin's suggestion. You may get it from a very good commentary. So I encourage you to do, first of all, your own work, and then go to a commentary and read and see what someone else has to say. You want, as you read, to give special attention to weighted words and phrases. Now, in this computer age, if we want to add weight to a word, what do? We put it in bold, we underline it, we put it in italics, we put it in shadow, we put it in any number of different fancy orthographic dimensions so that it just jumps off the page at you. Now, the biblical narratives were a little more limited in their technology than that, and as a result, they developed a little more sophisticated means of adding weight to words. And some of these are explained in books on biblical narrative. Let me just mention a few of them. One is, if you're in a narrative context, and suddenly you shift into poetry, the diction is elevated, then you might think, oh, this may be a very crucial part of the narrative. Sometimes Jacob's words to his sons are couched in poetical terms. Samuel's rejection of Saul is, you're moving right along in a prose context, and suddenly you have two verses of poetry. And some scholars have said, hey, that's poetry. It's from a different source. We need to get it out of the way and then interpret on that basis. I'm seeing my signal, so I think I will take a break now and we'll come back. I'm sort of midstream on that, but we'll pick it up when we come back after another 10-minute break. Are we good about the big hand now? Big hand, 2 to 12. And we'll meet again.